Morning. I'm so glad to be with you all this morning. It's good to be back with friends and family, as I mentioned in Sunday school this morning. Let's just call it like it is, because you all are family to me. A lot of you all have been a great encouragement. Dave and I have known each other for several years now, gotten to know each other over the last several years and grown closer together, become fairly decent friends. I wouldn't say we're great friends, but that's not true. Dave and I, we have a great relationship, and I'm thankful for the opportunity to come in and share with you this morning. Always enjoyed coming up here and taking part with you all. Now, we're going to be walking through, as I made mention in Sunday school this morning, we're going to be walking through the Sermon on the Mount. So if you want to turn to Matthew chapter 5 is where we're going to start out this morning. Well, actually, we're really going to start Matthew 4 just briefly, but it's the last verse or two of Matthew chapter 4 and then get into Matthew chapter 5 there. Because there's an interesting statement there at the beginning, and we'll get to that in just a second. So in order to understand the rest of the Sermon on the Mount, we really have to start with the Beatitudes. That's where it all really begins. Now, what we typically do with Beatitudes is we usually go over them one by one, and we typically itemize them to some degree. And that's typically how I've ever heard preached in my lifetime, is we itemize these things. We separate them. We read them. Or blessed are those who mourn, and blessed are those who are poor in spirit, and blessed are those who are hungry and thirsty for righteousness. And we look at those as things that we need to do in life, and that's great. But I'm going to challenge you with something this morning that maybe you've never thought of and maybe you've never heard before. I have no idea. I was never taught this. This is something that I came to the conclusion on my own, which could be dangerous. But I'm 99.9% sure that I'm right, with that 0.1% chance that I'm still right. So, but the reality of it is, I know this is correct. This is a correct way of viewing this. The Beatitudes are not meant to be looked at separately. They are a progression of where you're at in your faith. What do I mean by that? Well, I'll explain it in a minute. But I want you to think of it as a litmus test of where you're at. We line up somewhere in one of those categories. But before we get there, let's get into our passage in Matthew chapter 4, starting in verse 25, going through verse 3 of chapter 5. Great multitudes followed him from Galilee and from Decapolis, Jerusalem, Judea, and beyond the Jordan. Seeing the multitudes, he went up on the mountain, and when he had seated, his disciples came to him. Then he opened his mouth and taught them, saying, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." Now, Jesus had been healing the sick, performing miracles, and for some, that's amazing. It's incredible. They thought they had their one personal, one-stop shop hospital that they could go to anytime that they wanted to. This is the way that people oftentimes think when it comes to physical needs. One of the things that I'm going to challenge you to think about, because we oftentimes don't even realize that we're doing it, I want you to take a look at your prayer list. And I want you to ask yourself the question, how many people on our prayer list are we praying for spiritually? How many people do you make mention of for spiritual needs? I've challenged Pleasant Ridge with the same thing. And I could tell you, everyone, with the exception of maybe one or two of those people on that prayer list, every one of them are physical needs. I'm going to tell you something. Yes, I want people to be physically healed. I am not saying that whatsoever. But I'm going to tell you something. There is a spiritual ailment that is plaguing the entire world. There are spiritual problems that people are facing on a regular basis, and we need to be relying on each other to help us get through them. I'm challenging you to think you need to be praying spiritually for your brothers and your sisters and for the world. Because at the end of the day, our physical ailments are nothing. At the end of the day, it's heaven or hell. There is no difference. It's going to be one or the other. I told you in Sunday school that we recently, Carla's mom recently passed away from pancreatic cancer. I've had the privilege and the not so privilege, I suppose, if you could say that, to bury five family members. I've become, on my mom's side of the family, the preacher of the family. Great, no problems with that. I can tell you there's a stark difference in burying someone that is not in Christ versus burying someone who is. And it's hard when it's family. These people were searching after physical healings. It kind of reminds me of Jesus when he was feeding the 5,000. He sets them down, they get this food, and then they come after him the next day because, hey, their meal ticket has left. And they go searching after him, and Jesus said, "You're looking for bread. You're looking up the wrong tree, because what I have to offer you is my body for bread, because I'm the bread of life." And they didn't like that answer. And a lot of people left because they couldn't grasp hold of, one, this what he's talking about, and two, Jesus is only convenient to follow when he's offering something that I can physically have. So many people struggle with this. So many people are in this position that I would follow Jesus if I could see a physical change. And it oftentimes isn't going to be that way, because we look at our lives and we think, for Christians, life oftentimes gets harder, not easier. And we want life to be these raindrops and lollipops and rainbows and whatever it is. We want life to be easy, and it's not. People in the world seems like those people who are on top, who don't love God, deny God even existence, and they seem to be successful all over the place. And we think to ourselves, why not me? Why do I have to struggle this way? And these people don't seem like they're suffering at all. And well, their suffering's coming. And I'd rather suffer here than have to worry about what I'm going to have to face later. Because a little bit of physical struggle is nothing compared to the eternal torment that some people are going to have to face. So in order to get to the Beatitudes, we have to understand where the people's hearts were at. These are people searching after these physical healings. They want these things to happen to him, and he sets them down. And the first thing he tells them are, blessed are those who are poor in spirit. And I want to tell you something. In order for you to have a relationship with God, the first thing a person has to do and be willing to do is to admit that you and I are broken. Because until you're broken, you're never going to pursue that relationship with Christ. You're never going to see it. This is why some people have a hard time giving their life over, because that means they have to admit that they are broken. And brokenness is something that the world cannot stand. We, in our society today, if something's broken, what do we do with it? We throw it away. We don't even try to fix it. We look at it and it's like, well, it's cheap enough just to replace it than it is to try to fix it. When we look at our lives the same way and we think, well, I'm not broken, I just do something else. And we try to pursue after the next big thing or the next thing that's going to bring us what we think is going to be happiness or joy. And then we realize that doesn't bring it, so we chase after the next best thing. Over and over again, repeating the cycle of thinking that the reason I'm upset or the reason I'm unhappy is because of the fact that I just don't have what I want. But the turmoil inside of us is reminding us that we are a broken people. Some of you who know me know a few years ago, I went through probably the worst time in my life when I dealt with anxiety. It's one of the hardest things I ever dealt with. And I'm going to tell you something. Before I could be healed, before I could fix it, I had to admit that I was in my core broken. And something had to change because the same old was not cutting it anymore. And if you're in a place in your life where you are broken and you have not done anything to solve it, you're going to continue to suffer, chasing after things that bring no value whatsoever. You see, the next thing that Jesus talks about it in the next verse in Matthew chapter 5, verse 4, it says, "Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted." I'm going to tell you something. If brokenness does not create within you a desire to feel pain, a desire to repent, a desire to know that you're broken, to recognize your brokenness, because until you recognize the need to do anything, you won't. You see, poor in spirit, this brokenness isn't going to account to anything if you don't do anything with it. Because this idea of brokenness will lead you to this idea of mourning for God. See, here's the thing. If you don't take the next step, you're just going to continue to be in the same place. Woe is me, woe is me, pity party for everyone. And it doesn't work. And we wonder why we continue to be the same place, because we are not learning to mourn for our brokenness. When we realize we've done this, it's the biggest mistake of our lives that we will mourn. For we realize the pain that we've caused, not only to ourselves, but maybe to others. This morning is induced. It's not like losing a loved one. The mourning is directly tied to our sin. There's two types of mourning. The first one is mourning that leads to bitterness and more pain, or there's mourning that leads to change. I want you to listen to the words of Paul when he says this in Corinthian letter 7, verses 8 through 10. He says this, "For even if I made you sorry with my letter, I do not regret it, though I did regret it, for I perceive the same epistle made you sorry, though only for a while. Now I rejoice not that you were made sorry, but your sorrow led to repentance. For you were made sorry in a godly manner, that you might suffer the loss in nothing. For godly sorrow produces repentance, leading to salvation, not to be regretted. But the sorrow of the world produces death." Do you see the change? Do you see the difference between them? This sorrow, this mourning, this grieving can do one of two things. It can either lead you into more pain and more bitterness. And don't we know people like this that are so in much in pain that their life is completely inflicted with this idea, it's everybody else's fault, it's not mine, they never take responsibility for it, and so they become more and more painful. And they not only are they painful in themselves, but they create pain for others because in their life they think it's their fault that I'm this way, it's their fault that I'm in the position that I'm in, and they become more and more unrealistic in their own reality. So bitter, so turned against God that they don't even recognize who they even are anymore. But then there's the other side of this. This sorrow, this mourning that leads to repentance. This sorrow that reminds you that change really does need to happen. I heard a message years ago at a graduation ceremony. Of all places, this is the message that I heard. All we can do is mourn and pray. At a graduation ceremony. Could you imagine the kids who heard that message thinking, "Oh, thanks for the pick-me-up. Way to go out there and champion the world." But the more I've thought about it, the more I realize how true that message was that they needed to hear. Because in life, you can look at things from two perspectives. Everything's great, Everything's fine. Everything's okay. And on the outside, everyone thinks, hey, so-and-so's doing great. But on the inside, that you are absolutely in pain. And we won't let anybody know it. So we turn to everything else. We think, I never thought he would do something like that, or she would ever do something like that. But you don't know what they were dealing with. Mourning and praying, desiring to do something better, having something better, changing your life to experience something better because you realize that you cannot stay in the same place. Mourning gives you closure. It allows you to put to death not only the thing of which you're struggling with, but it also allows you to be able to move on. That's the beauty of mourning, because it allows you to close the casket, close and put to death those things of what you're holding on to. Which brings us to the next one. Blessed are those who are meek. Now, to be honest with you, who in here knows what meekness is? Okay? How many, I'm just going to ask the question, believe that the word meekness means weak? Be honest, raise your hand. Who thinks it's weakness? I always thought that. It sounds a lot alike. Maybe Dave's done a good job with you. I doubt it. Oh, he's going to love me after this week. But meekness, as we know, is power under control. It's power harnessed. I like it. I grew up on a horse farm. And we had 9 horses at one point in time, and I raised them, rode them ever since I was a little kid. I'm going to tell you something about horses. Horses don't do what they do because they have to. Horses do what they do because they want to. The closer your horse gets to you, the more that they trust you, the more that they'll do for you. It's the truth. Because they know you. If you're nervous, they'll be nervous. If you're scared, they're going to be scared because they feel all of that on them. And they know it. If you're confident, they'll be confident. They trust and begin to know their rider and emulate what their rider does. There's 2 different ways that you break a horse. Now, the old style way, the old cowboys would get on them and they'd ride them until they broke their spirit. That's one way of doing it. And then there's another type. And I learned this from an Australian horseman. That you train the horse to love you. To use their strengths and their abilities to bring them close. For instance, horses are extremely curious. So if you turn your back toward them and crunch down against the floor, if you're having trouble getting them, if anybody has horses and they always run away from you, quit running after them. Turn your back towards them and lean down and just wait. Give them a few minutes and they'll come over. They'll put their head right over your shoulder like, what are you doing? They'll do it. Because horses are curious animals. They want to know what you're doing. Why are you doing that? Meekness is a lot about allowing yourself to be controlled, allowing yourself to submit. And the more that you submit, to allow yourself to be led by God, the more you allow yourself to be driven by His commands, the more you begin to love that individual. I've been married now, we'll be married 17 years this August. I had to look back at her for a second. I'm like, am I right about that? Yeah, it's 17 years this August. We've been together 18, but we've been married almost 17. And I thought I knew what loving someone was like when we first got married. I think everybody goes through that, right? You think you're, oh, I know that person. And then you move in with one another. Some of y'all are laughing because you know exactly what I'm getting ready to say. Then you move in with one another and you realize you know nothing. Because life is a battlefield. And marriage is hard at the beginning because you got two people that have opposite opinions and you're trying to make that work. And Carl and I, when we first got married, lived in an apartment that was 350 square feet. One bedroom, small kitchen, small living room. I'm going to tell you something. And we were together 24/7 for the first 3 months of our lives. And I'm going to tell you something. We loved each other, but we about killed each other. Because it was hard, because you're trying to figure each other out. We didn't know each other the way we thought we did. But as you develop and as you learn one another and as you develop that relationship together, you start learning each other, start knowing each other, and start drawing closer to one another so that everything that you do keeps your spouse in mind. Well, at least it should. And I know that doesn't always happen, and I understand that. But my point is that as you draw closer, the reason why oftentimes marriages fail is because that bond, that communication fails along with it. It just does. And it's hard. When we are drawing closer to Christ, when we're submitting ourselves over to Him, we're drawing closer to Him, and we want to get to know Him better. Guess what the next beatitude is? Because here's the thing. As we're drawing closer, the more we want to submit, the more that we love Him, the more that we desire after Him, then we start craving our time and attention with Him and what He has to offer to us, which is the next one. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. Because once we understand and we submit ourselves and we trust the Lord fully in everything that He does for us, we submit ourselves completely and we start craving what He offers. We want to know Him more. We want to know everything about Him. We start doing everything, investing our time and our efforts into our lives to the point to where we are soaking everything up and we just want that relationship because He is that important to us. And so we start bringing it in. And sometimes, and by the way, these beatitudes oftentimes can happen in a very short period of time. Sometimes for others, it's a long process. It depends on who you are and what you're willing to do about it. If you're unwilling to submit to God, you might be in that meekness stage for a long period of time because you refuse to submit to Him. And you're like, I've never had that desire before. It's maybe because you're not submitting to God. Maybe you're not totally trusting Him or giving your life over to Him. Maybe you're not seeing that. Don't be jealous if you see other people do it. Figure out what's wrong and fix it so that you can develop that relationship and draw closer to Him. That's the whole point. As you hunger and thirst for that, you bring in what He has and you start not only loving Him, but then you start emulating Him, which is the next two. Blessed are those who are merciful and who are pure in heart. Blessed are those who are merciful and are pure in heart. Think about that. Mercy is a gift that you give to someone else. We talk about grace. Grace is great. I love grace, everything about it. Here's the thing. We don't talk enough about mercy. We don't talk enough about it. Because mercy means we have to be willing to do something about it. Grace. Oh, God give me. We want to take whatever God gives us, but when it comes down to giving to others, whoa, that means I have to sacrifice something. My time, my energy, maybe even some problems that I've had with an individual in the past. I'm going to tell you something. I guarantee with a congregation this size, there are some of you here that are holding on to problems that you need to let go of. I don't care what they are. I don't care if it's with a person or a situation that you have dealt with. The only way that you're going to be able to be free and truly move on and emulate what God has and what He's given to you is to be able to let go of whatever is holding you prisoner. And here's the interesting thing about mercy. And when you refuse to offer mercy to others, you are living in a prison that is built by you. You built the prison walls. You've got the key in your hand. But you refuse to turn it. When you hold on to pain and when you hold on to things that someone has done to you or something that has happened to you in the past, when you refuse to let that go, you are holding on to that key, knowing that it's there, refusing to turn it. Saying, I cannot let myself free of it because I will not let it go because it means too much to you. To be free of it means that you have to learn to step outside of where you're comfortable. It's comfortable to hate. It's easy to hate. Hate is an easy emotion. It's an easy emotion because it doesn't require anything from you. But to forgive, to show mercy, that requires real effort. And if you're going to show mercy, the first thing that you have to do is to be pure in heart. Because if you don't have purity, if your motives are not pure, you will not show mercy. If you do, it's not going to mean much, or you don't even say it. Well, I forgive you. You say it externally, but in your heart, you're still carrying it. And by the way, people, when you forgive them and you know, and they know you don't mean it, will pick that up. And they'll hate you even more for it. Or they may despise you even more for it. Here's the reality. There are some people that want to be forgiven so bad for something that may have happened between you and them. And they want so desperately to be forgiven of it. But you refuse. And they're afraid if they come to you, what the reaction might be if they say it because of your response. They don't want to ruin any more of it. They don't want to dig themselves into a bigger ditch. And so here's the thing. Forgiveness has to start before you ever confront them. You have to be willing and able to let go of whatever it is and say you're forgiven long before you ever say the words utter out of your mouth. Because if they're not forgiven here, nothing that comes out of your mouth means anything. So it has to come from a pure heart. This idea of mercy and purity are simply the same. We're going to spend more time on this, by the way, on Tuesday. I've got a whole message dedicated to this one thought. So be pure, be merciful. James 4, 6 through 7 says, but he gives more grace. Therefore, he says, God resists the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Therefore, submit to God, resist the devil, and he will flee from you. But here's the other thing. I kind of got ahead of myself. That's okay. I've preached this message, or these messages over the course of the last 6 weeks, so I am so familiar with this, I'm getting ahead of myself. The next one is an interesting one because we always mess this one up. Blessed are the peacemakers. Here's the problem. This is how we view this passage and how we read it, and we don't even know that we're reading it this way. Blessed are the peacekeepers. Now, you might think, well, that's just semantics that I'm saying here, and they're not. Blessed are the peacemakers. A peacekeeper, man, my bass is really in. Blessed are the peacekeepers, are people who are willing to keep the peace no matter the situation. And in a peacekeeper's mind, as long as we're not fighting, we're good. As long as there's no problems, we're good. And what I say, no problems, I mean on the surface. So we view things on the surface saying everything's good, everything's great, nobody's fighting, everybody's all right, but here's the reality. It may not be. And so many people, we're so afraid of conflict. Let's be honest. No one, hardly anybody likes conflict. There's a few people that really like to argue and like conflict, but very few people like conflict. We don't like to talk about it. We don't like to deal with it. If there's a situation, we'd rather bury the axe and leave the handle sticking out, thinking, well, it's no big deal. We'll just leave it there. But it's a constant reminder. It's out there. We walk by it every once in a while. And then every once in a while, we dig that problem up. We start yammering about it, and it starts becoming a problem. But eventually, we've got to be willing to let that go. Peacekeepers will only deal with the external. Keeping the peace, no problems, everybody's okay, and no real issues are happening. Peacemakers make peace happen. It makes peace happen What I mean by that is if there's a conflict, we go and we resolve it. If someone's got a problem with you, we need to be practicing Matthew 18. Going to the individual. I've told people, if you've got a problem with me and you don't come to me about it personally, I'm not listening to it. I won't. Because apparently it's not that big of a deal to you. If you run to anybody else about it, you're not dealing with it, you're gossiping. So stop it. If you run to anybody else and don't say it to the person you've got a problem with, that is considered gossip, that's talebearing, and that's a sin. If you can't say it to them, don't say it. That's a hard one that people oftentimes don't even realize that they're doing. Because we hate conflict so much that we'll avoid it. And we'll tell everybody else except for the person we've got conflict. People who want peace, really want peace, they will confront it and deal with it. I tell people all the time, come to me. You got a problem with me, come to me. Let's resolve it. Come, let us reason together. Isn't that what the scriptures tell us to do? Let's work it out. Let's try to figure it out. We got a conflict, let's resolve it, let's move on. I'm going to tell you something. When I dealt with anxiety, I was a peacekeeper. I put my emotions to the back. I kept everything hidden. I never told anybody what I was dealing with internally. I was this mangled mess. Outside, I looked fine. But I wasn't. I was completely and utterly a wreck. Until you admit that you have a problem, you can't truly fix it. And if you've got a problem with someone, fix it. Resolve the conflict. Deal with it. Show forgiveness to those who need to be shown forgiveness. Blessed are those who are merciful. Blessed are those who are pure in heart. Blessed are those who keep peace. But not only with each other, but you have to have peace with God. If you don't have peace with God, you have nothing. Because you're not going to resolve any conflicts without having God at the center of all of it. You have to be willing to let go of everything that you had. And then finally, it's probably the hardest one because we don't like to talk about this one. Because talking about this one means that it's going to be hard, and it is hard. Blessed are those who are persecuted. A person who makes peace within themselves and with God and with others is capable of being able to do things that other people cannot. There's a group of individuals in England in the 1400s known as the Lollards. I've read quite a bit on them. There's a book came out years ago by Keith Sisman called Traces of the Kingdom. That's a great book. But I've read more than that on these particular groups. And what's interesting about the Lollards, these individuals. They called themselves the Church of Christ, by the way. That was interesting on its own. But here's the interesting thing about them. These guys were so committed to being obedient to Christ, they were willing to do whatever it took to follow him. During that time period, during the 1400s, the Catholic Church was pretty predominant in that area. And if you didn't convert to Catholicism during that time period in history, they'd kill you. They'd put you in jail, they'd torture you for a while, but if they couldn't get you to recant, which would mean to give up on your past faith and take on the Catholic faith, if you didn't do that, then they would eventually torture you. There was one particular gentleman, I don't remember his name, but I love this guy for one reason. He had lived his life proclaiming to love Jesus. They put him to torture, and he recants. Matter of fact, I think they cut the ends of his toes off. Kind of gruesome, but that's what they did. And he recanted because he was afraid what was coming next. He goes back home after this happens. He was so ashamed of what he did. He told his family and the church, I will never do this again. And he purposely went out in the middle preaching the gospel again. But this time, he did not recant. And they took him to the middle of the square of where they did the executions, and they burned him alive. Another instance of this same group of individuals, his family and his loved ones, while they are marching him off to be burned, his family said, "Stay strong, be faithful, you can do this." Could you imagine what the world could do with Christians who are like that? Because we complain about nothing. And we get so inundated about ourselves that we don't even realize what people around the world are dealing with. There are people in the Middle East, if they are baptized into Christ, they immediately have a mark on their head. And they're killed for their faith. There are people in India, if you are in the wrong place in that state and they catch you evangelizing or proselytizing, is what they call it over there, proselytizing to their people, they'll kill you. And we're here complaining about people, "Someone said something mean to me." And then we call that persecution. We got to do better. Because here's the thing. When you're at peace with God, and this is what the scriptures tell us, if God be for us, who can be against us? Because at the end of the day, as I mentioned at the very beginning of this message, this is a heaven and hell situation. This is not something, this is not playtime, this is not something that we do just for fun. This is real, and this is life-altering, life-giving, or life-destroying. And we've got to be willing to take the stand of where we're at in our lives. And these Beatitudes will tell us where we're at in our faith. Are you to the point to where you recognize that you're broken? Are you willing to admit that you need Christ and that you're willing to give your life to Him? If that's where you're at, then be willing to step forward and give your life to the Lord this morning, because that is what we're called to do. Do you recognize your brokenness? Do you know who you are as a sinner, that you need forgiveness? Have you fallen away from the Lord? Have you gotten to the point to where you've lost some of that hunger, you've lost some of that drive and some of that vigor that you once had for God, and you find yourself in a place where you're struggling to even submit to God? Recognize where you're at and continue to pursue after wanting and developing that desire for Him again. Are you not willing to show mercy? Are you not willing to have that purity in heart or have that purity in heart? What are you doing? Where are you at? Are you willing to let go of that past? Are you willing to show peace and have peace with others? Where are you at in your life? And if you're not to the place to where you are willing to give your life to the Lord, or have given your life to the Lord in the fact of sacrifice, then you haven't arrived yet. And you're not good enough. And I'm going to tell you something. Those people in that position never thought they were either. We're never to the point to where we can say enough is enough or I'm good enough. Those attitudes remind us of who we are and where we're at in our faith and where we walk and how we're supposed to live and what we're supposed to do about it. Don't neglect it. Don't turn your back against it. But give your life to Christ, understanding that there is nothing better in this world than Jesus as Lord. Because no other ruler, no other principality, no other government can offer you something to what Jesus offers you, which is a life eternal with Him. The more I know Him, the more I love Him. The more I love Him, the more that I understand that I want to share His love with others. Because time is running short. And time, your time, could be running to its conclusion. And you may not even know it. Because you're not guaranteed tomorrow. And you're not guaranteed next week. And you're not guaranteed next year. Here's the excuse that oftentimes people give when they say, "I'm not going to give my life to the Lord." They say, "I'll do it eventually when life gets easier and when life isn't as hard as it once was. And I'm not so busy and I can truly dedicate my life." And kind of reminds me of a t-shirt that I had years ago that said, "Procrastinators unite. tomorrow. We tell ourselves, I'll commit to Jesus tomorrow. Or I'll take a line from the Amanda Show back in Nickelodeon's day and back in the 90s. I'll get to it eventually. She was the procrastinator, a superhero. Don't do that to yourself. If I've learned anything over the last year and a half with burying family members, with dealing with people who say that they're going to give their life to the Lord and don't, and then their life ends. It is hurtful and it's heartbreaking. And I want to see everyone come to know who Jesus is. Because at the end of the day, that's all that matters. Are you willing to give your life to the Lord this morning? Come make that decision. I'm going to turn it over to Dave here.
Will everyone please stand? They'll get ready and lead us in our invitation here this morning. Have thine own way, Lord.